in terms of advice, just do it. Just like trust it. Go all in, because nothing bad's going to happen. There's only good coming from the work. You know, if you're worried something might not come through, just trust the process.
From To Be Magnetic, this is the Expanded Podcast with your host, Lacey Phillips. As the leading destination for neural manifestation, we dispel the woo-woo in order to help you create real, tangible results based on neuroplasticity, psychology, epigenetics, and energetics. Our goal is to normalize the practice of manifestation and empower you to get into the driver's seat of your life in order to manifest the experiences, relationships, and things that most align with your authenticity. Part of our manifestation process entails expanding past your limiting subconscious beliefs. Therefore, by tuning into this podcast with interviews from experts, thought leaders, spiritual teachers, scientists, and those with neural manifestation success stories, you're starting the process of expanding your subconscious in order to see to believe that anything you desire is possible. And by pressing play, the process begins.
Okay, guys, we have a really exciting surprise summer sale going on right now, and we wanted to share with you here on the podcast as well. We're always looking for ways to get more of you in the pathway and make it more accessible for everyone. So we only have a few really big sales a year, and this is one of them. We have a really fun discount spinner where you can spin the wheel and take your chance to lock in a membership rate anywhere from $25 a month to $12 a month. Any discount is helpful, I'm sure, but we have some really great ranges on here and it will lock you in at this rate for an entire year. So this sale is so exciting for new or returning customers. Unfortunately, it's not eligible if you are in active membership, but if your membership is expiring soon, look out for a renewal offer in your email. So don't miss this. It's not going to be around that long, only a couple of weeks for the summer. And if you've been on the fence with your Pathway membership, trying to figure out when you want to pull the trigger and finally start your official manifesting and unblocking process, now is the time. You can find the link to the spinner in our show notes on our website or on our Instagram bio. Feel free to send the spinner to any friends or family or anyone you think that has been on the fence and really could benefit from using this work. Now is the time to buy.
Welcome back to another process episode, which is where we showcase one of our Pathway members who have gone on to manifest something extraordinary or big within their life, may it be career, home, relationship, financial. This has become one of your favorite podcast segments that we have, as we can tell by the numbers. And one commonality that I want to make that you'll begin to recognize each of these Pathway members share in common from past episodes to new is that not one of them simply dipped their feet into the work or flirted with it. They went all in. I've been able to see this recently with my dad, who's doing the work. They sort of touch in, don't really do the DIs, do it once in a while, skip around the workshops without finishing them. Whereas what you'll listen to with each of these episodes, these are the people that started with how to manifest, moved into shadow, moved into inner child, did all of the workshops, listened to every one of the supported classes, which is our once a month class where Jessica and I go through in the Pathway answering members' questions. And then they've gone on to listen to every podcast episode. That's what you will hear from each of the Pathway members that we share on this. And not because we're only picking people who do that, the ones who actually manifest the big things, they go all in. And not only that, but once they've gone through the work, and they get a baseline of it. They make it their own. So a past guest, Heather Whitaker, you heard that in The Deep Imaginings, she started out with them, listening to them, and they weren't as effective to her. So she figured out her own process that when she walks on hikes, she talks the prompts aloud. So she'll listen to them in her earbuds. Once she's heard the prompts, she then goes and talks out what's been prompted until she gets to the block, and then she reprograms it. And you have to imagine, even as you're walking and listening, you're in a hypnotic state because your brain, your conscious mind isn't flying around. You've now gone into an alpha or a theta. So that's what you'll also find in commonality with these members. They make it their own. They don't stop when they get a roadblock. They actually figure out their own way through it. Today will be no exception. So I'm going to kick it over to my co-host, Jessica Gill, who you've heard on the Explained episodes and the Process episodes, as she highlights another really exciting member within the pathway and how they've gone on to manifest something extraordinary.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Process. I am so excited to introduce you today, Aisata Himmelfarb. She is a Pathway member who has gone on to manifest her absolute dream job, really unblocked so much that was in her shadow, and allowed for this career who so many people told her she couldn't have it in this location, she couldn't have it remote, she couldn't have it like this, was able to get every single thing that she wanted on her list. Aisata I really resonated with because she has a very pragmatic, cerebral, perfectionist side to her. And she learned how that has really taken her so far in her life, but also not keeping it in balance can cause a lot of blocks and internal turmoil as well. So we uncover some of those blocks for her. We also talk about the magic dark period and what it feels like right before a manifestation comes through, or when you're really being pushed against your edge and deciding whether or not you are really going to stay with this old programming that no longer serves you, and how can you stay in trust during that really, really challenging time when you're up-leveling. So I'm sure you guys will love this episode. And without further ado, here is Aisata. I am so excited for our guest today. We have Aisata. Welcome.
Thank you. So exciting to be here.
Yes. As you know, an avid podcast listener, what is your primal triad, your sun, moon, and rising?
This is so, you think that I would have looked into this knowing that I was coming on the podcast, but I only know that I'm an Aquarius.
Oh, amazing.
So all I know is that I'm an Aquarius. I toy around with a CoStar app once in a while, but I'm not too deep into it. Fully believe in it, but I just haven't dug into it.
I get it. That makes so much sense. There's only so much you can fill your brain with and so many different modalities. So that makes a lot of sense. But Aquarius is so cool, very free-spirited. Do you feel like that aspect resonates with you?
Honestly, I never really identified with that part of it. I feel my default is to be a very kind of cerebral type A, very analytical, logical person, almost to a fault. So whenever, you know, whenever people say that about Aquarians, I'm like, I'd never felt that. But I don't know, maybe it's just like a part of me I haven't explored.
You know what? I guarantee you got some Capricorn in there somewhere, or maybe a Virgo. That's like grounding you down for the practical.
I'm going to have to double check when we're done.
Yes. And then what is your cultural background and upbringing?
So I was raised by immigrant parents. They grew up in Mali, which is a country in Western Africa. And they actually moved to the Soviet Union, or it was the Soviet Union at the time, for university and for grad school. So I was born in Moscow when it was still the Soviet Union. And then we immigrated to the US because my mother's mother was actually an American citizen who had married her dad, who was Malian, and they went back to West Africa, which is why she grew up there. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, my parents kind of had a choice to make about, are we going to stay here? No one really knows what that's going to look like. Do we go back to Mali? You know, with our daughter, there's not a lot of opportunities there. So they were so lucky that my mom was an American citizen born abroad. So she had that passport. So she was able to get green cards or visas to start with for my dad and I. And then we moved to the US. her mom had left when she was 3 years old, and they didn't see each other again until my mom was 25 and I was three. So we left Moscow, moved to California, lived there for a couple of years. And then also, luckily, my mom joined the U.S. military because she had that American passport and a college degree. She was able to join as an officer, which comes with a lot of better paying, kind of higher level opportunities than when you enlist. So that kind of was our turning point as a family, financially and opportunity wise. We moved around a fair amount. I'd never lived anywhere longer than 3 or 4 years when I was growing up. In California for a little bit, a couple of places on the East Coast, and then my parents lived overseas sometimes. So a little all over the place. Beyond that, so Mali is a Muslim country. So my family is practicing Muslims. I stopped observing when I was in middle school. And then when I met my husband, now husband, I converted to Judaism before we got married. So there's a lot there.
Wow. It's so cool and so rich in culture too.
Yeah, it's been actually really fun planning our wedding because it's been this experiment in how do you meld all of those things together and make sure that you're really representing all of them. I feel very lucky that I had all of those experiences and all that exposure because I was also very connected to Mali growing up. I had family in Europe and in Mali, and instead of going to summer camp every summer, my parents would send me to France or to Mali to spend time with their family. And I, you know, at the time I was kind of like, why can't we go to Disney World? Like all my classmates, I have to go like hang out on grandpa's farm with the goats. But it was actually really huge for me. You know, there are times where I'm sad and I feel like I don't have as much of a connection to it because I didn't grow up in it, but I'm so grateful for what I did have. And they made a really concerted effort to make sure that I have that.
How do you feel like that influenced sort of your beliefs and like who you are today?
Yeah, it's hard when you grow up an immigrant kid. The communities that I grew up in, my parents were really intentional about also making sure we lived places with really good schools. And that ended up being more affluent areas where a lot of the time I kind of felt very different and other from my peers, you know. There were a lot of times where I was the only person of color in the friend group. I definitely was the only kid whose parents spoke another language at home. For a long time, I had this sense of not really belonging in the communities that I grew up in. And I think that's pretty common for immigrant kids. But I think that as you get older, you start to embrace it a lot more. You know, it kind of shifted from feeling, you know, like, I wish I could just be like everybody else to like, I love this thing that makes me so different from everybody else.
Yeah, it's like fully integrating that aspect of you.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think that the TBM work had a lot to do with that.
That's so exciting. So how did you find TBM? What was your sort of entry point to it?
The Goop podcast, where I find everything I love. I heard Lacey's interview on Goop back in 2019, it must have been. And as a very cerebral person, I was like, well, this is incredibly woo-woo. This is not for me. I'm not interested. And I just couldn't stop thinking about her interview. And so I was like, browsing the website a couple of times very casually and looking at kind of some of the workshops. And then right around that time where I heard that, I was moving to New York. I got a job offer to leave DC and go to New York. And I was just like, well, we're doing all new things this season in our life. So why don't you just try this also? And I can't remember if I did an a la carte workshop or if I subscribed immediately to the pathway, but I started off at like Unblocked Inner Child. And I remember doing my first DI, and I just, within 3 minutes, I was sobbing hysterically on my couch, like the best tears, but I was just like, okay, there's something here.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting, everyone's different entry points in, because some people hear the spiritual side of it and they're like, yes, this is what I want. And then some people hear the very like practical psychology, neuroscience aspect, and they're like, this is fascinating. And so many times people start with inner child, and like that's kind of the hook, because you really get space to feel into all of the, you know, maybe you've done inner child work before or in therapy or something like that. But in the DIs, at least I had this sense of, oh, wow, I'm actually feeling into the emotions at that age. I'm not thinking cerebrally about the age, but I'm feeling into the emotions of it. And that was definitely like I've never had an experience like this before.
Yeah, 1,000%. And also, I think part of it is the emotional environment that I grew up in was not one where we really talked about our feelings or accessed our feelings. My parents were in survival mode for a lot of their life, and I don't, you know, hold that against them at all. But it's just in terms of like the hierarchy of needs that they were trying to meet, we were trying to like meet the basic ones for a very long time. And so it wasn't until later in life that I felt like I could start even paying attention or even thought to pay attention to, you know, emotional needs and feeling your feelings and things like that. So, you know, when you're doing the first DI in inner child and it's telling you to like picture yourself, I vividly remember it was Lacey saying to picture your like child self when you felt your most authentic or something like that. And I just was like, it was so emotional.
I think that's so beautiful. And I love how you said too, you know, you don't hold it against your parents for being in that survival mode, because I think that's so common of so many parents to like just be in the place of we need to have all of our bases covered so like we can take care of our kids in the next generation. And I think especially imperative for immigrant parents, because they're like, okay, I'm creating this whole new life here. I'm taking this risk. I'm away from family. How can I support my family in a way that I couldn't have been supported in other countries perhaps? And acknowledging that because they were in that survival mode, maybe you didn't get the emotional support you wanted. But that's okay because they were able to support you in other ways. And now you are like kind of living out the dream of what they wanted was now you can have your needs met and then tap into your emotional side, which is really beautiful.
Yeah.
So what did you call in first?
So I had a really interesting approach to TBM. When I started and joined the pathway and was doing the work, I never wrote a list. If you asked me at the time, I would have told you I'm not doing this for concrete or material things. I think if I'm really honest with myself, I was too scared to make anything concrete. Almost like, you know, if you don't say what you want, then you can't be disappointed when you don't get it. And so that's how I was approaching it. And it still works. I mean, it works. You're still learning a lot about yourself, doing the work. But until this job, I didn't write anything down concretely. I was just working my way through stuff. And I mean, part of it, I think I needed to be there. I felt like I needed to get to know myself a little bit more. And that was primarily what I was using it for. So I did that for a long time. And then a couple of months ago, I was in a dark place in professionally. And I was like, I have literally nothing else to lose. So I just sat down and wrote out what I wanted in my next job. And I was really specific about it. And I had paired that with a session that I did with Heather Whitaker, and she kind of gave me tips about defining what it is that you're looking for when you're calling something in. And I thought that was really helpful. And so I wrote down what kind of job I wanted, where I wanted to be, a minimum salary that I wanted, down to like what kind of firm and where I was working. I got real specific, and it all came through. It was wild.
That is so cool. I think that's a really good point too. You mentioned of like, I definitely came into the work with that mindset too of I'm just looking to better myself. I don't really want a tangible item. And in certain chapters and periods of your life, that very well may be true. But I think part of the beauty of this work is leaning into the ability to use it to manifest those other big things like a job or a home or a partner or whatever it may be. And realizing that, you know, at least for me, I was like, oh, I don't want these material things. I'm not a material person. It's like, we're on the physical plane. We're all material people. Like,
totally.
That's a shadow. That's just not true. And okay, maybe I'm not a material person in the way that I see materialism, but what does it look like for me? How can I be better comforted, soothed, have a better work environment, have better this, better that, and then start crafting the list in that way? And that's when, you know, it sounds like you kind of tapped into that and got really specific in it.
Yeah. And Heather was key for that, because what you're saying echoes a lot of what she told me. She was saying that when you're writing down the things that you're looking for, you need to ask yourself why, like, how does it relate back to your authentic code or your money code or whatever it is? You're not, you know, you're not asking for these things in a vacuum. There's a reason you want them. And getting really clear about what that was kind of made it easier for me to be like, okay, it's not just that you don't want to commute. There's a reason that you want to work remotely, because, you know, you have better balance that way. You have more time to do your hobbies. You have more flexibility, things like that. And then it kind of takes you out of this focus on a material thing, and it makes it more, you know, something that is going to serve you for a reason. It's like what you need.
Absolutely. And I'm just looking at what you wrote for your list. So you had like paid you more money, was in your field, a specific sector of your field that was either an organization or company based in New York and would let you work from New York, where you kind of were saying anyone in your industry, you ask them for this position in New York, they'd be like, you're crazy, you have to move to DC. and that was some sort of like private sector firm. I always love when people say, oh, that can't be done, or this is how it's done, or the industry's here, so you can't do it anywhere else. There's like a rebel child part of me that's like, I'm going to prove them wrong.
Yeah.
It's just not true. Like whenever anyone says, well, this is how it's always been done, it's like, great, there's tons of things that's always been done that way. And now things are done differently. So let's improve and let's also see and be that expander for other people, you know, show the people that think you can only have this job in DC that it is possible to have it somewhere else too.
Yeah, it's so funny that you say that. I think, you know, it's been a really bad year for a lot of people, but I think that if one good thing has come out of it, it's kind of like testing our assumptions about what is possible. I just was like, there's no reason that I can't do what I do from New York. There's no legitimate reason for it. I was scared to put that on my list. And I told Heather this. I said, I don't know if I want to say on the list that this job needs to be remote. And my husband and I were having conversations about being mentally preparing ourselves to potentially have to move to DC. Again, I had nothing to lose. I'm going to put it on the list. And when it came through, it was so funny because a lot of people were in a low point at my previous job, at my previous organization. And a lot of people reached out to me and said, how did you find this? Like, how is it possible? And I was like, if I can find it, you could find it. You know, it was nice to see that that was an opportunity for me to expand their idea of what's even feasible.
Yeah, it's definitely been such a hard year for so many people. And I think one beautiful silver lining is this construct of the working environment and where it can be done and how it can be done and how does it navigate and work remotely, because everyone had to go, or almost everyone had to go remote in a lot of their positions. And, you know, what is quality of life remote versus in office, and productivity remote versus in office? And I think it really expanded a lot of people in companies to see that, this may actually create better working results because people have autonomy over their day and they can go get groceries on a Wednesday morning, but then they're going to work later in the afternoon because they don't have to commute that day, you know? So it's really kind of opened everyone's eyes, which is really beautiful. Okay, so one of the things you wrote down was, looking back at your process, you were surprised that none of the blocks came up as they seemed. On the surface, you said they were directly related to career, and you're like, okay, cool, I'll go do Unblock Money, and then presto, I'll have a new job. That's not really how the process worked for you. So go into that a bit.
Sure. Again, being very like literal, I thought, you're looking for a job, do the Unblocked Money thing. That's what makes the most sense. And I did it, but it wasn't, I don't think that the timing was right. I wasn't getting that much out of it. So I decided to go back and do shadow and take a couple of things through shadow. And then from there, I shifted to the magnetism challenge when I was in my kind of waiting period. I went through, I think at a high level, I would describe it as just like unblocking deep, deep blocks and trauma that were not directly related to career and money, but were affecting how I showed up everywhere in life, including at work. And then once I got through those and things started showing up and I was in this kind of magic dark waiting period, I was going through the magnetism challenge because then I just needed to kind of like sit with the uncertainty of what was coming next. And that's really difficult for me because I really like to control outcomes, or I try to. I tell myself that I can. And so that was helpful for just kind of helping me stay connected to myself in that magic dark space.
Definitely. What sort of blocks were you coming up against in shadow and in the other workshops?
So I would say one of the big ones was unraveling this kind of pattern I have of people pleasing. I think it comes from, you know, I mentioned earlier, growing up Black, a woman, an immigrant, very different from my peers in environments that were very white, pretty affluent. And I was the only person who looked, sounded like me, had that experience. And you know, I don't want to say that I was aggressively bullied or anything, but I was always very aware that I wasn't quite like my peers, and they always made me very aware of that. Kids can be mean to each other. If you ask them now, I don't think that they meant it the way that they do, but that's just adolescence. And I think that what I learned to do really early on was to kind of almost contort myself to try to be what I thought other people needed me to be, to kind of accept me, to like me, whether that was peers, teachers, employers. Some of that also came from some family issues. I think that a lot of that came from my relationship with my dad, which hasn't been the best. And I spent a lot of time trying to do whatever I needed to do to earn his approval. So I think that that bled into how I approached things at work. Do you ever have a moment when you're in the interaction with a person and you're like, I'm not being myself? I'm just so out of the moment that I'm just looking at how they're responding to me to kind of like see how I need to tweak what I'm doing so that they will like me, approve of me, want to hire me, et cetera. And that showed up in interviews sometimes. You know, I would be in an interview and I would hear myself talking and I'd be like, what are you even saying? Like, what are you talking about? So I kind of went through that and just trying to see where the people pleasing came from, how I could kind of rein that in, not feel so compelled to do that, be comfortable in my interactions with people who normally whose approval I would just be dying for, with, you know, the idea that they might not like me, or, you know, I might not be the person they want to hire for this job, and that's completely okay. It's not for me, and what is for me will find me. I also had a lot of almost like an inferiority complex around money and material things, which is so funny. I talked with Heather about this a lot, where my family wasn't really, really well off. Their socioeconomic status changed a lot as I grew up. So, you know, when we moved to the US, we were literally three of us living in the bedroom of my grandparents' house to now we're very lucky. They own two homes. They made a lot of progress in their careers. I'm so thrilled for them, but I never left that space where we were three people living in my grandparents' bedroom. When I was growing up, just constantly comparing like material things that I had to what my peers had. I remember in middle school, a dark time in fashion, but Abercrombie and Fitch was like a really big deal. And I just remember like my Abercrombie was always from clearance at some warehouse that we went to, whereas all my peers had it, you know, from the store that season. And my dad, bless his heart, would like give me a little cash so I could go to the mall with my friends and feel like I wasn't the only one who couldn't buy something, even if it was something really small. And so I was always comparing my economic status to other people's. And then as I grew up, it's interesting, when I went to high school, I moved with my mother, and our socioeconomic status changed significantly from where we were, but I was still in that same space. I was comparing myself to my peers, feeling I didn't have enough. Meanwhile, I'm like going to France on summer vacation, you know, like we're not very wealthy, but like I had everything I needed and more. I just never felt that. And that kind of lack mentality followed me through college. I noticed that when I started making my own money, it was showing up with the things that I chose to buy. Almost like there was like that little middle school girl in me who was like, I need you to buy these things so I can see that we have them now, that we can have those things that we didn't have before. And when you're in a lack mentality that way, it shows up in other places. That's not the only place it shows up. So, you know, I thought, I noticed that it was kind of manifesting in the way that I was approaching the job search and like not believing that I would find another job, not believing that I would find what I was looking for, that I was qualified enough. So going through all of that was so eye-opening and kind of life-changing to realize those things. Because some of it is so deeply ingrained, you don't even realize you're doing it. I'm like, why can't I stop buying nice purses? It's not because you like them. It's because you're trying. There's something inside that you haven't addressed or you haven't looked at yet. So yeah, those were my two big focuses.
I love that, because I think, you know, just being the outsider listening to it, I'm like, oh, all of those things directly correlate to career. But when you first see the outside of it, you might not even have recollection of those memories or how you use money that way or how you compared these status symbols amongst your peers at those age. And it's so funny you say the sort of like discount Abercrombie and Fitch stuff, because that was so the trend when I was in like middle school and high school and all of that stuff. And I remember they would have like knockoff version, or not, I guess it was the real version, but like at a Marshall's or something like that. And I would always try to get the discount one and be like, yeah, I'm good enough because I have it, but it's like even discount. And it had the same sort of imprint that you have, but I took the reverse, which is, oh, well, if I can get it at a discount, then I should do that and save my money. But it's that same lack energetic. And yours was like, oh, I can only get this at a discount. Well, in order to be good enough, I have to get it full price and I can pay for it and all of that stuff. So it's so interesting how it presents and shows up so differently, but it's still that lack root. And I also just want to mirror going back a little bit to what you said about feeling like you're in a situation where you're showing up with someone and you're like, who even am I in this? Like, what am I saying? I'm just like regurgitating nonsense to like have this person approve of me, and I don't even know what I'm saying. I relate to that so much. And I think any people pleaser out there will 100% resonate with that. And it's almost like, I don't know about you, but there's moments where you're like, I feel so small right now. Like, I feel like such a small percentage of who I am as a human. And like, whatever I'm saying or giving off is just not really me. I can't stop the train. It's already left the station. And now I'm just fumbling in front of this person. Like, how do I recuperate? Or like, maybe I'll just have to avoid this person forever because it's just not going to work in this social dynamic. It's so funny, the masks that we put on in order to feel a certain way. And it varies. Like, why can you be so authentically yourself with close friends and then around this person that you may presume high status or whatever it is, you're like, okay, cool. I'm going to change and be completely different. I also love how you made that connection with your dad and like wanting approval from him, because your father figure usually has a lot of masculine energy and career and money are masculine energy. And so it's like when you're stepping into your own masculine energy, if you're looking for his validation, it's probably very similar that you're also looking for that career validation or that boss validation or whatever it may be as well. Have you found that be a theme?
Yes. But I would say it comes from both of my parents. My mom has also had a really impressive career. I would say both of my parents live in their masculine a lot of the time. And I am the same way. I have a very hard time turning that off. Sometimes my husband is like, can you please stop emailing me? Like, I'm your employee. Like, best regards, you know? And I think that the other piece, and I think that a lot of immigrant kids will identify with this, is that you get a lot of your parents' validation from what you achieve educationally and professionally, which is not a bad thing. It's like my therapist and I talk about it all the time. Like, that got you to where you are and was really good and it served you for a very long time. But I don't know that it's, you know, if we want to live in that space all of the time.
And it's finding that balance, because that masculine energy does bring you that success and that career drive and all of those amazing things. But it's when you can keep it in balance is when you really start to be even more magnetic.
You know, it's like Pavlov's dog experiment. You know, you do this thing, you get a positive reinforcement from it, so you keep doing it. So, you know, as a child, my mom would go to Costco the summer between grades and buy me workbooks for the grade that I was entering. And then we would go through the answers together. So, I mean, like, my earliest memories are being validated for like being good in school, doing well in sports, just like being high achieving. And that's kind of like the way that my parents and I would, it was a big part of our relationship. At some point, they stopped having to be the ones to be like, you need to do A, B, C, and D thing. And I became the one who would start to kind of parent myself. And I mean, I remember in college, it got really bad and I had to pull back from some things because I was just piling on so much and being the one to put the pressure on myself and living in that energy. And at some point it became unsustainable for me, even though it was how I got validation and positive reinforcement from other people.
Yeah. Well, because you're also doing it for the reward and not necessarily listening to what you authentically want or desire. It's like when it stops becoming your desires and starts becoming someone else's, that's when it gets into kind of like the difficulty zone with that.
That's how I almost went to law school. I think everyone has an I'm going to go to law school phase, but.
I feel like almost every friend of mine has like been to law school or almost gone to law school or was thinking about it and just ultimately walked away from it because now I don't have any female lawyer friends. So then I like this idea too, that you sort of loosely dipped your toes into the work and were moving through everything, but it wasn't until you like really cast your list that you started seeing, you know, tests in real time, interviews rolling in. What was that process like?
Yeah. So I would say if I look back to before writing down a very specific list, I kind of went through the process in stages. You know, I arrived to the point where I was like, it's time for me to leave the current role that I'm in, but I didn't write anything down. I just was like, keep going through the work, keep doing the DIs, keep journaling, but just kind of like put feelers out there very casually. Frankly, I was being aimless. I had no idea what I wanted. I had no idea what I was doing. I was on LinkedIn for hours a night. I was applying to positions outside of my field. And I had told myself, you know, whatever you're meant to find will come to you. This was a really big learning experience for me because I've realized since that I am a person who needs a very specific list. And I had something else come through literally a week ago where I wrote down a specific list and later that week something came through. So I was applying to jobs outside of global development. I was applying to nonprofits again, even though I said I didn't want to work for a nonprofit ever again. And then the universe was like, we're just going to keep pushing you until you get to where you need to be and write something down. And things just kept getting worse and worse and worse in my role. I became so unhappy. My husband was like, I've never seen you so miserable. And I was at a point where that was my rock bottom. I am a very risk averse person. And I called him in the fetal position on my bed. And I was like, I'm gonna quit without anything lined up. Like, I can't keep doing this. So that was where I was like, okay, well, we've got nothing to lose. So let's just like sit down and be really specific about what it is that you're looking for. And that's when I was like, okay, I want a higher salary. I want to stay in my field of global development. I want to be based in New York or be allowed to work from New York. I want to be at a for-profit consulting firm. And after that, it was like I couldn't see anything but those kinds of jobs anywhere on LinkedIn. And I think that I was thinking about this today, actually. I think that a lot of what I was seeing was actually tests, like little baby tests coming through, because there would be jobs that weren't quite in the sector or that said in the description, no remote, we're like only remote until COVID is over and then you're expected to be in DC. And I started being really almost surgical in where I was applying. And then I started putting it out there that I was looking for this. I reached out to people. I'm not a really great networker, and every other job I've had, I found because I came across the description online. But this time I was just like, I'm going to reach out to everybody I know. I'm going to tell them this is what I'm looking for. And that's when I started hearing from people, this job doesn't exist for you to be in New York. Like, you're going to have to move to DC, blah, blah, blah. And I just kept plugging along. I was like, I wrote the list down. I put it away. This is what I'm doing. This is what we're doing. And then I started getting emails for interviews. And there were some where I was kind of excited about it. There were some where, you know, I didn't think this was really what I wanted. I turned down a couple of interviews. I think that that really upped kind of the magnetism of this whole process for me, being able to say no, because for me, I've always felt a sense of like desperation almost when looking for work, like, please, please, someone take me. And so for me to, you know, I had an offer come through that was a low ball and it wasn't quite what I wanted to do. When I turned it down, I had some interviews come through where I was like, this doesn't look like a company I want to work for. So I said no to that. Partially out of trying to conserve my energy, you know, it's exhausting looking for a job and interviewing while you're working full time, but also just telling myself, like, we're not wasting our time anymore. You only have 24 hours in the day. And then I remember there was a week where I had an interview with a place that I had worked for before when I was in grad school, and then the firm that I am with now, and then two other firms that were similar to where I am now. The roles were fine, but they didn't get me excited. And the one that I really wanted was the firm that I'd been with before. But the company that I'm with right now has a really good reputation in my field. So I was like, you would be an idiot to, you know, say no to this. And the description, the job was literally in the field that I have my master's degree in. It was like everything except it was an unknown about whether they would let me work remotely because the job was based in DC. And the other company, I had a sense that they would let me work remotely because I knew they had remote people in my role. So I was going through the interview process. And the more the process went on, the more excited I got about the company that I ended up with until I got to the point where I was like, I really want this job. It was everything. And I think that at that point, the shift for me moved from being specific about what you're looking for, preserving your energy and your time to really go after the things that you think are what you want, to being okay with the waiting and the unknown, because there were a lot of unknowns. It was a long interview process. I think there were four stages. I had to take a test. I taked one section of it. It was really hard. And then on top of that, there was still the question of, even if I got to the end, were they going to let me work from New York? So at that point, I was a little ball of anxiety for a lot of the time. You know, like I said, I'm a controlling person. I try to control outcomes as much as I can, even though, you know, that's an illusion. It ended up coming through. I mean, it was... The thing that was most surprising to me was how seamless it was. It didn't feel forced. And I think that that is so important, because when you are trying to muscle something into place or to kind of like force it into being, for me, my experience has been a lot of the time that that wasn't the place for me to be or the thing that I needed. And it was so easy. Besides failing that test, you know, I had my interview, my screening, I had an interview with the people who would be my team. And then they gave me what amounted to a verbal offer. Like, we were talking start dates, and I felt like that was just another step for the universe to really be like, okay, now you need to really sit with it, really be patient and see what's coming. Be okay with not knowing how this is going to turn out, because after that, there were still a bunch of HR hoops that I had to jump through. And so I will honestly call that my magic, another magic dark, because it was so difficult for me because of the experience that I wrote about when I reached out, that experience I had in my early 20s about, you know, having kind of your dream job ripped away from you. It was really, really triggering. It was bad. The weekend between getting the verbal offer and having HR come back and say, this is the package we're offering you, blah, blah, blah. I canceled plans that weekend. I couldn't do anything. On top of that, I was still working a job that was really bleeding my soul dry. And then it came through. Looking back on it now, I'm like, you could have just been patient and waited. But it was difficult. It wasn't easy. I had this idea that, like, if, you know, I went through the steps, when the thing was coming through, it was going to feel very like easeful and I'd be floating through life like some earth goddess hippie. No, it was messy. It was rough. It was tough. But it was, I think, a process that I really needed to go through.
So I'm quickly interrupting this episode to invite you, if you're ready to start your manifestation journey, or if anything you've heard in our manifestation episodes has piqued your interest, to begin. We have a la carte workshops in everything from the basics bundle, which is what we recommend to everyone who starts. It's the formula that actually teaches you how to manifest, unblocked inner child, and unblocked shadow. We also have a la carte workshops on love and money. But the real gem is the Pathway membership because it encompasses every single workshop we have. It's a year-long membership with full access to the few a la carte offerings we have and exclusive workshops not available anywhere else, such as the daily practice, which is what everybody in the Pathway uses, hopefully at least 3 times a week to daily in order to truly create the new neural pathways that one needs in order to manifest, and houses the library of our deep imaginings, which is our unique hypnosis process that allows you to get into your subconscious and overwrite those old neural pathways, creating the new ones.
And as I mentioned at the top of the episode, we currently have our surprise summer sale. So if you're looking to get started in the Pathway, right now is the time to buy. For a couple weeks only, we are offering our surprise summer sale where you can get one of the best rates in order to join the Pathway, anywhere from $25 to $12 a month, depending upon what you spin in the spinner. So for anyone who is a new customer or a returning customer that wants to sign up for the Pathway once again, this sale is for you. Any active members, this offer is not eligible. However, if your membership is expiring soon, don't forget to always check your email for your renewal offer. So check out our show notes, our Instagram bio, or our website to access the spinner and claim your lowest rate of the year. And join us in your manifesting and unblocking process.
Okay, now back to the episode.
It seemed like one of the hardest parts that you came up against with this manifestation coming through was that week and a half between the verbal offer and everything coming through. And for most people, they're like, oh, fuck it, a week, whatever. Like, let the manifestation come through. But for you on your journey and your patterning and what's happened in your life, that must have been a really challenging spot to just sit still and deal with all of the fears, the control, how do I sit in grace and deservingness when I literally can't do anything more? I'm waiting for their response. And how do I feel safe in my body, in my space, in my whatever, while I'm waiting for this outside piece? And would you share a little bit about that grad school story? Because I think that really helps to paint the picture of why this waiting period is so painful, because that situation went so badly.
Yeah. So when I was in college, I decided that I wanted to join the Foreign Service, which is a diplomat, be a U.S. diplomat. And this was kind of like all I'd wanted to do probably since I was 17 years old. I was one of those kids who kind of always knew what field I wanted to work in. And besides questioning the specifics of what it looked like, I'm working in the space that I said I was going to work in when I was about 18 years old. But that was the dream job. It's why I did the major that I did in school. It's why I did the internships I did. It's what I really wanted to do. I started taking the Foreign Service exam when I was like 19 years old, just because I was like, I need the practice. And then I had moved to Rwanda for an internship right after college. And so I was interning at the American Embassy there in the consular office. And I met my boss at the time, who was in this fellowship program. And he was like, this would be great for you. You know that you want to be in the Foreign Service. You're literally going to grad school next year. Apply for this. He wrote my letter of recommendation. It was perfect. I was like, this cannot be real. I was accepted to the program. And the deal it still exists. If you're accepted to the program, there's a really rigorous application process. You interview with ambassadors. It's really challenging. But once you make it through, they pay for grad school, which is great because that's expensive. And then you pay them back by committing to a minimum of 5 years as a U.S. diplomat. I was like, this is what I wanted to do my whole life. I'll be there for like 40 years. Are you kidding me? You take the Foreign Service exam, which I passed on my first try. It was great. I was like, everything is lining up. You're supposed to do a summer internship. I was placed in the economic office at the embassy in Paris. I was like, come on, guys. Like, could this be any better? Like, what is going on? But part of, you know, working for the government is going through a security clearance. And for diplomats, you go through something called a suitability clearance, which is, you know, there's kind of like an ethical, moral aspect of being able to represent the U.S. government overseas, which is valid. I think it's fair. I was 22 or 23 when I was accepted, and I disclosed in my background interview that I had smoked a joint twice in my life, once when I was 16 and once when I was 22. And looking back, everyone who I told that I disclosed was like, you should have lied. Like, why did you do that? But I was, you know, grew up a military kid. I was like, no, if I'm honest, like, it'll be fine. And they had told us in the program, you know, the goal of a program is to bring in people who were underrepresented in the Foreign Service. So, you know, that means sometimes people have things in their history, their background. So they were like, there's ways we can work through it, whatever, we'll make it happen. My understanding from people is there was some kind of political shift, something changed internally on their end, where they weren't really willing to be as flexible on some of those things. So I got a letter saying that I was unsuitable to represent the United States because I smoked two joints.
Oh my God.
Every Black person who reported that they had used drugs before was kicked out of the program. I know for a fact that at least one or two of the white fellows who disclosed things like, you know, cocaine use, or recreational drug use are currently U.S. diplomats. And when they kicked us out, they told me that I had to pay back with the money that they had paid for grad school. So that was a year of grad school. There was an appeals process. So I was able to appeal. I got all these letters of recommendation. I poured my heart out into this letter and they denied the appeal. So then I had to pay them back for the year of grad school. And then, you know, at the time, what was the lowest point of my life, I had to make a split second decision about, am I going to drop out of grad school or am I going to continue grad school? Which meant I had to take out a bunch of student loans. I was lucky that I hadn't had to take out undergrad loans, but that's a lot of money. And I just didn't feel, you know, I had 1 year of work experience under my belt. I was living in DC. This was the plan. Like, I was half win for a penny and for a pound. Like, I was like, I'm going to finish my master's degree. So I did. I took out a bunch of loans. I finished it. But it was the worst emotional, because there is something different. You know, you can get fired from a job and you're like, it wasn't the organization for me. My work wasn't up to par. My heart wasn't in it. There is something when you're a kid whose hopes and dreams have been to do this work, to get a letter from that same organization saying you're unsuitable. It was really awful. We actually ended up trying to sue for discrimination because it was just like
so blatant.
Yeah. Guys, I was like, could you guys have like made it a little less obvious? But we did an EEOC complaint. And then in the middle of it, the Trump administration came into power. So we were just like this. They dismissed the case. It was dead in the water when that happened. And it's fine. Like, I'm fine, right? I'm okay. I stayed in the space that I wanted to work in. I love my job. You know, if I hadn't lost that fellowship, I probably wouldn't have met my husband. There's a lot of good that comes out of it, but there is still the lack of trust in things just working out. Like, I remember, I think I wrote this when I was in the midst of my like waiting for the formal offer to come through. I had literally convinced myself that it wasn't going to come. And there was no sign outside of me pointing to that being the case. It was just that like HR hadn't emailed me in 3 days. And I was like, well, that's it. That's what happens to you. And I remember lying in bed and being like, things don't work out for you. And on one hand, there was a part of me that could be like, you need to take that through a DI because that's like deep, deep wound. But the other part of me believed it. I really believed it. And I don't think I fully healed it. I think that's something I'm going to be working on for a little bit. And it was interesting because if you had asked me before, I would have been like, I'm over it. Like, I have the life that I always wanted. But it's clear that that experience still lingers.
I'm so sorry that happened to you. Like, that is such a horrible, horrible situation. I love that you have so many silver linings from it. And I think it also touches on something where it's like, we can do all the right things in life. We can do all of the things that we think are going to set us up, especially for success or happiness or whatever. And sometimes life just like fucks you over, for lack of a better word. Bad things, unfortunately, do happen. We have to really be cognitive of how those things are affecting everything after that bad thing happens. You know, the fact that you can look back and be like, okay, I took from that situation that things don't work out for me. That doesn't help me in my life. How can I reframe that? How can I prove to myself the opposite? How can I show myself examples of the opposite and really start to shine on the other side? And the energetics of what happened to you at that time, where you were honest, you were doing the right thing, you were a perfect fit, it was your dream situation, is all very similar to the job that came through. Like you said, perfect thing, everything on my list. You know, I was nervous about it not having this. Same exact energetics. And then that waiting period, it's kind of like the universe asking you, have you healed that horrible incident? And do you believe now that you're worthy of this? And can you stay in trust during that process? And I think one sort of misconception is that you're not going to spiral during that time. And if you spiral, then the manifestation won't come through. And that just hasn't been my experience. That hasn't been other friends' experiences. Kind of how Lacey says, you know, our thoughts do not control our reality. It's our subconscious thoughts. And as we're raising our subconscious worth, even if our daily thoughts dip, our subconscious worth has risen. And so I think in that moment, during the week of waiting, yes, maybe you had spiraling thoughts. Maybe you freaked out. Maybe you were scared. Maybe you were convincing yourself it wasn't going to come through. But because you had done the work, because you had been doing DIs, because you had done all of this groundwork, your subconscious worth, even though a part of you still has that limiting belief, it's not nearly as powerful as it was before. And so that's why it's able to just kind of come through.
Yeah, it reminds, I was literally this morning listening to the podcast, just kind of like binging episodes. And I think it was you and Lacey were talking to Dr. Tara about kind of like your baseline self-worth. And that made me think about that a lot, because I was like, in that moment, if you asked me, where's your self-worth? I would have been like, in the gutter. I'm a disaster right now. I am a mess. Like, what are you talking about? But I had done enough work that it just wasn't, that moment wasn't the truth of who I was.
Yes. And that is kind of the most beautiful thing, is that even if you have moments of a low, or your self-worth dips momentarily or through this one piece of process, if you're doing the work, it's cumulative and you can only grow your self-worth. It can't be diminished. It can't be taken away from you, which I think is really beautiful. Were you using DIs or anything to support you during that time?
I was doing a couple trigger DIs, but I mean, I was so triggered. I know that it sounds crazy to people, like, she had a verbal outlook. Why was she falling apart as much as she was? I was in a really dark place. And I don't think that it was just the fear of it not coming through. It was the thought of what I had to go back to if it didn't come through. You know, like, I'd have to start all over, go back to the drawing board, continue in this role that I was really unhappy with. So I was doing I was trying to do a lot of self-care. I saw myself spiraling into some numbing behavior. I have a tendency, you know, when things feel too much, you know, I just want to like veg out in front of the TV, like order a bunch of takeout, not really feel my feelings. And sometimes that's what you need. But there was a point where I was like, all right, I saw it. We got to reel it in a little bit. We're getting a little crazy with this. So there was, you know, it was meditating. It was reading. It was doing like sound baths, like anything to help me ground a little bit.
It's almost like there's so much frantic energy going on in that little waiting period that whatever you can do to just keep your mind clear and calm, even momentarily, is helping a ton.
Yeah, sometimes I would just put on binaural beats on my like headphones and sit on the couch and close my eyes, because your mind is so good at making up stories that I had to do something to kind of disconnect from that and remind myself that like this is a narrative that my mind is weaving. Part of it is trying to protect me. I think that I was trying to say, you know, if you mourn this now, when it doesn't come through, you won't be as disappointed and you'll be able to just move past it. And I had to kind of stop that process as best as I could.
I think it's so brave to try to fight that process because it's so ingrained and it's so easy to go back to it because it's such a strong neural pathway. You know what I mean? That's the pathway that's protected you from pain, disappointment, rejection various times. So of course, it's a really easy pathway to lean on and go back to. But the hard part is being, this feels extremely uncomfortable and I don't know how to sit with this feeling. What do I do?
Yeah.
But just pushing through and giving yourself the support you need is just so, it's the thing that brought your manifestation through.
I mean, I did still order takeout and watch Netflix, but sometimes I also meditated.
But that even allowing yourself to do that or being conscious of, oh, now I'm going down these patterns that like aren't great, but whatever. Sometimes that is honoring yourself. Sometimes sitting on the couch and ordering takeout is self-care.
Yeah, agree.
Who were some expanders you looked to?
So I had one that was very specific, who was a person I knew. And then I had a couple that were mostly through social media, honestly. And they each kind of served their own purpose. I had a former colleague from this firm that I had worked for when I was in grad school who lives in the Northeast, not in DC. Like she was in like Delaware, Rhode Island or something. And she works remotely for this company. She's still, when we travel, gets to travel internationally for work. The organization is based in DC. I was like, this is everything. She's getting to live the lifestyle she wants. She has the job that I want. She's good at her job. It's working for her. Like, this is great. So I had initially reached out to her when I was interviewing with that organization to, you know, ask her, you know, how did this work? How did you get them to let you work remotely? This is so rare in our field. And she kind of talked me through that a little bit. And she even told me, you know, just ask them if you get to that stage, just ask for it and see what happens. It's been a wild year. A lot has changed in our field and globally. So that was really helpful for me because I was like, we have the same master's degrees. We literally worked at the same place. We lived in the same city. We have the same professional interests and very similar professional goals. And it's kind of like what Lacey says about, you know, if you can see that person mirroring a part of you, it makes a big difference for what you think is feasible, for what you think is possible. So that was really helpful. The other piece was honestly people who I just saw like really being unapologetically and authentically themselves. And I think this goes back to the people pleasing piece that I was talking about. I just needed to see people who did not care what other people thought and who were, you know, as outrageous as it was, you know, as long as you're not hurting anyone, just living their lives and being really happy about it. So I really love Lil Nas X, the Yay. Rapper.
He's awesome.
I think the Montero video came out around the same time and I was like, he does not care. It's beautiful. I really love watching him. And he does it with such like a joy that I find really nice to see. Two others, honestly, Kourtney Kardashian is a big expander for me because I think she also is very unapologetic about being herself and saying her mind and not really filtering what she says for what other people want to hear. I mean, I think there's a lot for being a literal billionaire for being able to do that, but I think just seeing a woman, an older woman doing that is really great. And then I also follow this, I guess you would call her an influencer. Her name is Tinks on Instagram and on TikTok, and she's very joyful. She's about like living your life for yourself in a very authentic and joyful way. I think because I'm such a like serious type A person that sometimes I leave some joy on the table, I'll put it that way. And it's helpful for me to see someone who's, you know, being themselves and really enjoying life while also being really successful at what they do and doing what they love.
Yeah. And seeing that the two are not mutually exclusive, like you can have both of those things without compromising one or the other.
Yeah, I don't have to be serious all the time just to be taken seriously professionally. You know, I can still be a fun person and have joy and like what I do.
And when you were going through the workshops after you had first crafted your list, how often would you say you were doing the works or doing a DI? I'm always curious what everyone's sort of like daily practice looks like.
It was a minimum 3 days a week. So I'd say 3 to 4 days a week.
I think that's kind of like a sweet spot because I think it's enough where you're getting it in regularly, but you're not obsessing over every single day. It has to be this, you know, you're not so controlling over the process. You're like allowing the work to just be part of your daily routine without obsessing over, oh no, I missed a day or whatever it may be.
Yeah. And my personality kind of defaults to, I have a tendency of being like all or nothing. Like if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it every single day and I can't miss a day, or I start to like beat myself up. And I kind of intentionally try to aim for every other day so that it's kind of less of an obligation and more something that I want to do and that I feel like I'm getting a lot out of, instead of kind of berating myself about this thing. I don't want it to be a checklist on my to-do list. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It has to feel natural and like something fun to look to, even though it can be like harder, heavier work. It has to feel like I'm choosing this because this brings me joy.
Yeah. And now like I like to do the DIs in the morning before I've looked at my phone, before I've talked to anyone. I think it's a really nice way to set up my day. And I notice a difference in my day when I start that way.
Oh, same. Yes. I feel like it's the easiest to fit in that way too. And I've been really taking advantage of, like, Dr. Tara calls it the hypnagogic and hypnagogic, I think, states. I could be butchering that completely. But they're sort of like those meditative states you're in right before you fall asleep and right after you wake up. If you have trouble dropping into DIs, that is such a good time to utilize it, because you can drop in deeper during those brainwave states, which is really cool.
Yeah, I actually find it really difficult. A couple of times, like sometimes I'll have really early calls and I will, you know, tell myself, okay, I'll do it later in the afternoon. The quality of the experience is different, because by the time we're at noon or 1 p.m., I've had emails pinging all day, my phone's buzzing, I've checked Instagram, and I find it very hard to calm my mind from that state. So morning is kind of nice because nothing's taken up space in my brain yet.
Definitely. And you said journaling was a huge part of the experience for you.
Mm-hmm. The way I usually go through them is I'll do the DI and then I get up and I write through everything that came up, and then I kind of peel it back a little bit deeper. I find that I get a lot more out of it if I spend, you know, 15 or 20 minutes afterwards really digging through it with a pen and paper.
I think that can be so helpful too. And you had mentioned sometimes when you were having hard times dropping in that you would just like listen to Lacey's voice and focus on like the vibration to let it relax you and open up your psyche. And then when you were done, you're able to like go in and journal everything. Like it sort of loosened everything to pour out into the journal.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a tip from, I think it must have been one of the videos, or she said it at somewhere. I heard her say, you know, if you're finding that your mind's racing and you can't drop in the way that you want to, just focus on literally the sound of the vibrations of my voice. And sometimes I'll do that and I find that it's honestly very calming. It helps me kind of, and then I'll be like, oh, I'm in it before I even realize that I'm there.
Yes. So what is something that you would tell your younger self, having, you know, we kind of started off thinking, wow, my younger self would look at me and be like so proud of where I am today. What's something you would tell your younger self who may have been in a fear state or trying to control everything or scared about their future, or even your younger self who was in that master's program who was getting rejected in that moment? What sort of hope or just kind of like guiding light would you give them?
I would tell her to trust herself a lot more than she did. Similar to the people pleasing, I think I spent a lot of my early, late teens, early 20s looking for validation from external things and kind of not really trusting my own assessment of what was best for me, what was right, what my value was. I think that's probably the biggest shift I've noticed in my mid to late 20s. And it's kind of how Lacey talks about in some of the introductions to the DIs, when you like unplug that validation from other people, from external factors, and plug it into yourself. I thought if I could do anything over in life, I would learn that lesson when I was like 22.
And then what would you tell someone just starting out their manifestation process or thinking about starting their manifestation process? What can they look forward to, or what advice would you give them?
I would, in terms of looking forward to, I think that the best part, I think, is getting to know yourself really, really well. You know, I think we live in a society where it's really hard to spend time with yourself and to get to know yourself. And I really believe that's the most important relationship you're going to have in your whole life. And I think that that's one of the biggest things that this work has brought me. In terms of advice, just do it. Just like trust it, right? Don't do what I did where you're, you know, don't hedge. Just like go all in, because nothing bad's going to happen. There's only good coming from the work. You know, if you're worried something might not come through, just trust the process.
Oh, I love that. And now that you're in this new job and you're having such a good time, can you like vision hold for people who are about to have manifestations come through or just had one come through? You know, what does it feel like on the other side of all of that time and energy spent into going into this role and now you're there? What does it feel like on the other side?
It feels like arriving exactly where you're supposed to be. I remember even during my like initial calls and meetings with my team, just the energy of our interactions was so different from what I had been in for the past year and a half. I was getting emotional on an onboarding call because people were sending each other such nice kudos in our team's messages about presentations they were doing. And I was just like, not an experience that I had had for the past year and a half. And I felt like this feels so easy. This feels right. And any doubt that I had before, it's gone.
Oh, I love that. I'm so happy for you. Yay!
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it is so expansive and will really help so many people through all of the phases of manifesting. And yeah, excited to see what more is going to come your way.
Thank you. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Thank you so much for tuning into the episode, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, we did. And in case you're not totally ready to join the pathway yet, I wanted to share a few of our free offerings that I'll often suggest to people as a little bit of a blueprint to get them started on their manifestation journey. The first place I like to direct people completely for free is the Motivation. You can see it linked below or on our homepage as our testimony library. And it's categorized by different subjects, whether you're calling in career, money, love, wellness, and much more. When you're reading about a member's experience of what they manifested, you're actually seeing to believe and showing your subconscious that that very thing is possible for you. The second place I like to direct people is to the free clarity exercise, which is also linked below. In it, you get to try our own unique hypnosis process, learn about the science, and some journaling prompts. And the best part about this, you'll get a tiny taste of what it's like to go into your hypnotic state, bring your subconscious forward, and create new neural pathways while receiving clarity. And the third thing, if you haven't listened to it on this podcast yet, please go back to the episode titled Manifestation 101, where you'll learn the basics of neural manifestation to truly understand this process. So go ahead and check out those free resources, the Motivation, the free clarity exercise, and the episode Manifestation 101, all linked below. And in an effort to make sure to have representation in this process series, go ahead and submit any process testimonials you have, especially to our LGBTQ+ community, our BIPOC, as well as the WISE, which is anyone in the community who is 45 and over. All right, we'll be back next week.